This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Kay Tenenbaum with another edition of the Saturday Evening Post, beginning today from the January-February issue. Lincoln's Faith, How His Spiritual Journey Transformed Him and the Nation, by Joshua Zeitz. Early in his presidency, with the dread specter of disunion hovering over the nation, Abraham Lincoln began invoking biblical imagery to explain what was at stake. He appealed to divine providence, the providence of God, that God who has never forsaken his people, without whose aid we can do nothing. He gestured to the Almighty, in whose hands the fate of the Union rested. But it was not until the civil conflict began to claim thousands of lives weekly, and until death touched the Lincoln household in an awful, intimate way with the loss of his young son, Willie, that religion became a commanding force in his personal and public lives. Lincoln's spiritual turn combined a deep and probing exploration of divine intent and human agency and stark political realism. Abraham Lincoln, an erstwhile skeptic, was the first president to understand and channel the spiritual and institutional power of the evangelical churches. Over a century before, Jimmy Carter became the first born-again residents of the White House, and Ronald Reagan declared before the religious roundtable, "I know you can't endorse me, but I want you to know that I endorse you." Lincoln assiduously courted the Protestant clergy. Evangelical Protestants became the sturdiest layer of the Republican Party's foundation, and, by Lincoln's design, a critical engine of its electoral success in the 1863 off-year elections and their critical 1864 national campaign. From thousands of pulpits across the country, each Sunday, evangelical clergy sustained support for the war effort, even when the Union seemed lost and more sober voices called for an honorable settlement with the South. Lincoln's pursuit of the religious community is an underappreciated feature of his presidency. "You may depend upon it, the Lord runs Lincoln," a prominent Methodist layman proclaimed. Lincoln's personal faith and growing political reliance on evangelical voters deepened in tandem and led him over time to frame the meaning of the Civil War with words and cadences reminiscent of the King James Bible, a book he had memorized almost chapter and verse early in life, even before he was anything proximate to a believer. But Lincoln remained, as always, an iconoclast. Whereas evangelical leaders increasingly asserted that the Union was on God's side and God was on the Union side, Lincoln remained unsure. Unlike most evangelical Northerners, he did not believe in a personal God. Rather, he perceived God as a distant and unknowable force, his will mostly indiscernible to men and women. The war, Lincoln told Americans, was in some fashion divine retribution for the sin of slavery. Whether God willed that the North should win that war was another matter, and one of which he could not be certain. As the fighting bore on, Lincoln claimed to view himself as God's instrument on earth, meant to prosecute total war against the South until one side or the other lost. He had a role to play, one that had been divinely predetermined and from which he was powerless to break free. But he was genuinely unsure whether he was God's favored side. Lincoln called for a day of thanksgiving in August 1863 to celebrate the fall of Vicksburg to Ulysses S. Grant's forces and the Union victory at Gettysburg the month before, acknowledging that these victories have been accorded not without sacrifices of life, limb, health, and liberty incurred by brave, loyal, and patriotic citizens, and that domestic affliction follows in the train of these fearful bereavements, Lincoln called on citizens to recognize and confess the presence of the Almighty Father and the power of his hand equally in these triumphs and in these sorrows. God could determine winners and losers, but also subdue the anger which has produced and so long sustained a needless and cruel rebellion. It could change the hearts of the insurgents and lead the whole nation through the paths of repentance and submission to the divine will back to the perfect enjoyment of union and fraternal peace. The president hardly exaggerated when he observed that the religious people of the country had extended him the most unanimous support. But his invocation of religion was not just the stuff of political design. Just prior to the Union's costly win at Antietam in September 1862, Lincoln, who had drafted a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation but agreed to hold it until the next Union victory, lest it seem a measure born of desperation, informed his cabinet that he would regard the battle's outcome as an indication of divine will on the monumentous issue of presidential emancipation. Even the final draft of the Emancipation Proclamation, which was in most respects a dry, legalistic document, included an appeal to God. Lincoln deliberately framed the order as a war measure, not a moral blow against slavery. He needed political cover. Conservative Republicans and war Democrats might accept emancipation as a means to weaken the Confederacy, but not as a war aim. He also needed legal cover. He had no authority to expropriate the property of citizens unless he did so in his capacity as commander-in-chief in the service of putting down an armed rebellion. Still, at the urging of his Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, he closed, "Upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice, warranted by the Constitution, upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God." Lincoln's wife Mary told William Henderson, Lincoln's former law partner and later biographer, that for the better part of their marriage, Mr. Lincoln had no hope and no faith in the usual acceptance of those words. He never joined a church. While she felt that Lincoln had always been spiritual in some indeterminate sense, it was only when Willie died that he began to turn to religion as a way to make sense of the tragedy that befell his family and the larger tragedy that enveloped the nation he had been chosen to lead. He felt religious more than ever about the time he went to Gettysburg, she remembered, referring to his visit to Pennsylvania in November 1863 to attend the formal dedication of the Union Cemetery. Though he was not a technical Christian, he read the Bible a good deal about 1864. Francis Carpenter observed the same subtle transformation. An artist who lived in the White House for 6 months in 1864 while painting a portrait of the president, he believed that during the last 4 years of Lincoln's life, he passed through what few men could have experienced without growth and change. He told Henderson that if you could have resumed your old intercourse with him at the end of his 4 years, you would have found his religious sentiments more fixed, possibly more Christian, for deism is not Christianity. While Noyes Minor, a Baptist minister and former neighbor from Springfield, paid a visit to the executive mansion, Lincoln shared his growing belief that it had pleased Almighty God to put me in my present position and looking up to him for divine guidance. I must work out my destiny as best I can. Minor recognized in the president a man grappling to understand his role in a national tragedy and struggling to understand what God wanted of him. The clergyman, who had known Lincoln as a non-believer, now believed that if Mr. Lincoln was not a Christian, he was acting like one. Lincoln's brief remarks at Gettysburg revealed a president turning to the Bible for words that might make meaning of the carnage over which he presided. In the opening lines of his speech, he dated the nation's founding to 1776, not 1789, a subtle but important nod to anti-slavery radicals, many of whom had long held the Declaration of Independence as America's true founding document, and not the Constitution, with its two-thirds compromise in recognition of the international slave trade. How he said it was almost as remarkable as what he said. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. Might seem a florid way to say 87 years ago our nation was born, but to devout Christians, it was a familiar linguistic construction, similar to 70 years and 10, Psalm 90, chapter 10, 140 days, Esther, chapter 1, verse 4, and brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations, Revelations, chapter 12, verse 5. When he continued, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. He knowingly chose three purposeful verbs that appeared frequently in the King James Bible. We here highly resolve, Lincoln closed, that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Here, with the words, a new birth of freedom, Lincoln indicated a shift in the war's meaning, from a battle to preserve the Union as it was, to a war that, should the Union win, would result in the death of slavery. Joshua Zeitz has taught American history and politics at Cambridge University, Harvard University, and Princeton University. He is the author of several books on American political and social history and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, New Republic, and the Atlantic, among other publications. In a related sidebar, the Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln's 10-sentence address, delivered in just 2 minutes, is one of the most famous and powerful speeches in American history. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. November 19, 1863. A visit to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. What you expect is a history lesson. What you learn is how much we are all alike, despite our differences, by Tykesha Spivey Burton. When entering the transatlantic slave trade exhibit, the walkways are narrow, the lights dimmed, and visitors can hear waves crashing and chains clinking, which evokes the sense of being cramped and confined in the dark hull of a ship during the Middle Passage. As the descendant of enslaved people, I felt overwhelmed by this space at first. I felt the pressing need to rush through the exhibit to exit the seemingly tight space. But I took a few deep breaths, steadied myself, and continued to take it all in. As a student of African American history, I know the stories of my ancestors, but I had never seen so many artifacts of our centuries of enslavement in one place. The rusted wrought iron ankle shackles will forever be etched into my memory. As I looked upon them, I realized that my existence is proof of my ancestors' resilience. The National Museum of African American History and Culture sits on a 5-acre plot of land near the Washington Monument. Wrapped in ornamental bronze-colored metal lattice and inspired by the 3-tiered crowns used in West African art, the building's striking facade stands in sharp contrast to the stone and marble buildings and monuments that surround it. Since the doors opened in 2016, the museum has welcomed 10 million in-person visitors and millions more through its digital presence. One comes here for a history lesson taught through the prism of the African-American experience. What you'll also find is a powerful testament to African-American creativity, tenacity, and resilience. It's a beacon of hope and remembrance. Museums help people recognize how much we share despite our differences and how much those differences can help us grow, writes Lonnie G. Bunch III, the NMAAHC's founding director and secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. The museum's 105,000 square feet of exhibition space is organized into 3 sections: history, culture, and community, spread over 5 floors of galleries, 3 below ground and 2 above, with public spaces in between. With more than 40,000 artifacts in its care, the NMAAHC tells the story of the African-American experience with accuracy, honesty, and respect. Exhibits on the lower 3 levels focus on the history from slavery through the civil rights marches and beyond. Above ground, galleries celebrate the contributions of African Americans have made to the country and the world. As you rise through the various floors, both the subject of the exhibits and the physical space get lighter, transitioning from the darkest chapters of history to upper floors devoted to cultural, artistic, scientific, political, and athletic accomplishments. Museum staff suggests that the best way to experience the museum is from the bottom up, starting with the history section where exhibits are arranged chronologically. To access the history galleries, visitors take a glass-enclosed elevator on the main floor. The elevator serves as a time machine, transporting passengers 70 feet underground and centuries back in time. As the elevator descends, you watch the years on elevator shaft walls go by as well. When you step off the elevator, you step into the Slavery and Freedom exhibition, which begins in 15th century Africa and Europe with the transatlantic slave trade and goes all the way through the 1870s and Reconstruction in the United States. Further in the museum, you discover a stone auction block and a bill of sale for a 16-year-old enslaved girl who was bought for $600. In the background, recordings of enslaved people play in a loop, evoking the trauma of being regarded as chattel to be auctioned off and separated from their families. Nearby, a life-size statue of Thomas Jefferson, who called slavery an abominable crime, stands beneath his indelible quote from the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. Behind him are stacked more than 600 bricks, each one bearing the name of one of the enslaved people he owned during his lifetime. Other artifacts displayed in the exhibit include Nat Turner's Bible, a shawl that belonged to Harriet Tubman, and sets of tiny shackles designed to fit around a child's ankle. I was particularly captivated by a small piece of embroidered cloth titled Ashley's Sack. A placard states that it had been given to a 9-year-old enslaved girl by her mother as she was being sold away from her family. It was later embroidered in 1921 by Ashley's great-granddaughter with words explaining the history of the item. The stitched words were sweet and simple, but I was struck by how much love was reflected in the act of preserving this memento across the generations amid so much suffering. You walk up the ramp to the second level, where exhibits delve into the period following the Reconstruction, during which the country grappled with what rights the newly freed should have. You move through distinct periods from the Jim Crow era to the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement. Here is Rosa Parks' dress, a segregated rail car, stools from the famous sit-in at the Greensboro, North Carolina Woolworth, and shards of glass from the 1962 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Moving forward in time to level C1, an exhibit titled A Changing America, 1968 and Beyond, explores contemporary black life and touches on the events that galvanized the civil rights and black power movements. When entering this section, visitors are greeted with the iconic photograph of Black Panther Huey Newton, sitting in that high-backed wicker chair with James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, blaring over the speakers. The history lesson continues in this section, from the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. through the birth of hip-hop and on to the election of President Barack Obama. One might ask, why now? Why build such a museum in the 21st century? Actually, the idea of the museum spools back to 1915, when a group of black Civil War veterans formed a committee to build a memorial to African-American achievement. Although the measure received some support from President Hoover in 1929, Congress failed to fund the project. More than 70 years later, in 2003, the museum was established by an act of Congress. To bolster the museum's historical holdings, organizers in 2008 launched the Saving African American Treasures campaign, which encouraged ordinary people to donate historical items and family heirlooms. By opening day in 2016, organizers had amassed more than 36,000 artifacts, with approximately 3,500 on display. After an emotional journey through the historic portion of the museum, it's time for a pause on the concourse level in Contemplative Court, where a cylindrical fountain gently rains into a pool. The sound of the waterfall has a calming effect. Along the walls are quotes from notable African Americans. In the cultural and community galleries on the third and fourth levels, exhibits are organized by subject rather than by date. It's an electric mix of African American art, music, the military, and sporting achievements. Items on display include a pair of Muhammad Ali's boxing gloves, Halle Berry's Academy Award, and Chuck Berry's Cherry Red Eldorado. I am particularly drawn to a section called Making a Way Out of No Way, which features the creative ways African Americans cultivated and served their communities through education, business, religious institutions, and voluntary organizations. Particularly touching is a replica of the Hope Rosenwald School in Marietta, South Carolina, which served black children in the rural South. Nearby is a double victory, the African-American military experience, with attention to the dual struggle faced by African-Americans during World War II, a fight not only against fascism abroad, but also discrimination at home. The exhibit also spotlights the wartime contributions of African-American women. You come to an exhibit devoted to Afrofuturism, which is a movement in art, music, and literature that explores the intersection of the American diaspora culture with science and technology. A white tube-like structure illuminated in blue light lines one wall. Entering it, you feel as though you're boarding a spaceship. Inside are a variety of objects, ranging from Octavia Butler's typewriter to Nickel's Nicholas Star Wars uniform. Organizers frequently host panel discussions, workshops, and events. After waiting in online queues, I was fortunate to get a much-coveted ticket to the museum's second annual hip-hop block party, which in 2023 doubled as a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the musical art form. The event was more than a party. It was a surreal experience to watch performances by some of the hip-hop icons featured in the museum out on the lawn, in the shadow of the Washington Monument. There's far more to see here than can be absorbed in a single visit. For me, the core of the experience is a reminder that I stand on the shoulders of the many who went before me. I believe for many visitors, what comes across most clearly is the vital role of African Americans in the growth of this nation. I have long believed the Smithsonian can be the glue that holds the country together, said the Smithsonian's Lonnie G. Bunch III, even on a topic as challenging, as nuanced as race. Takesha Spivey Burton is a freelance journalist and photographer whose work has appeared in British Airways High Life, Travel and Leisure, Fodor's Travel, The Telegraph, and more. Accompanying Takesha Spivey Burton's article are a series of photographs, rusted wrought iron shackles, a trade dealer's card announcing the Great Negro Mart, handmade tin box carried by Joseph Trammell to hold his freedom papers in the 1850s and 60s, a square white shawl made of silk lace and linen given to Harriet Tubman by Queen Victoria around 1897 as a token of her admiration. Ashley Sack said the following, "My great-grandmother Rose, mother of Ashley, gave her this sack when she was sold at age 9 in South Carolina. It held a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair. Told her it be filled with my love always. She never saw her again. Ashley is my grandmother, Ruth Middleton, 1921. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Kate Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post. Good night.